Welcome to today's edition of the Rush Limbaugh Show podcast.
What a speech last night, huh? That was amazing. I didn't think they would actually, surpass the expectations I had in terms of spending and minimizing legitimate concerns that the American people have. Our telephone number, 800-282-2882. I am Brett Witterble, your guide host today on the EIB Network. This was an incredible thing to watch. Ladies and gentlemen, $4 trillion is essentially what we're talking about here. A $4 trillion spending spree. And it was worth noting right out of the box, Joe Biden stood there in the chamber with 200 members of the House, the Senate, all masked up appropriately. Chief Justice John Roberts behind him, historically noted by the president. Of course, the first vice president who was a woman behind him, and that was Kamala Harris, and of course, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. And he opened up with a borrowed line from Rahm Emanuel that was a borrowed line from a Chinese proverb, which is, this is about a crisis and an opportunity. And he went on from there to discuss his plan to just spend us into prosperity and employment. It was incredible. Some could say that this was an attempt to replicate Santa Claus. In fact, Rush, let's go to Rush right out of the box here, because Rush made it abundantly clear we can never compete with Santa Claus.
And folks, it's really, really hard to compete against Santa Claus. And that's how the government's viewed by a lot of people. In fact, a lot of people, that's what the government's for, is to take care of people. Feed people and provide for us what government, and you can't blame them. That's how they've been taught.
It's how they've been taught. But the reality is Santa has a workshop, makes all those little toys for the good boys and girls around the world, and delivers them out of the goodness of his own heart. The government doesn't do that. The government is not Santa Claus. The government is Looter Claus, maybe? I mean, really, it's almost as if the greatest act of looting was offered up last night there in this speech, and it's being sold to you like it's going to be a beneficiary for all of us. This is a man who is already $2 trillion into spending, and he's now proposing another $4 trillion. We're talking about $6 trillion in spending. It's an absurdly large number. It is an absurdly large number, and to hearken back to the reference of looting, the people being looted are our grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. President Biden stood at that dais and told you last night he wants to put people to work. He wants to put people to work. He wants to take care of the unemployed. He wants to make sure the unemployed in this nation are going to be taken care of. That's what he's talking about. Tim Scott offered the rebuttal last night. And Tim Scott, to sum up what President Biden was saying, essentially said, throwing money at this situation in this country right now is not the answer. Senator Scott.
We should be expanding opportunities and options for all families, not throwing money at certain issues because Democrats think they know best. Infrastructure spending that shrinks our economy is not common sense. Weakening our southern borders and creating a crisis is not compassionate.
It's important to understand what we're looking at here. It's important to unpack the underlying condition the country is dealing with right now. Right now, this minute, a little bit after 12 noon, on the 29th of April, there is a specific reason why the economy, why people who are not working are not working. There's a specific reason why, before we even get into universal pre-K, before we get into free junior college, before we get into college 4 years after you graduate, 40 years after you graduate, you get 4 years, you get 4 years, you get 4 years. Before we even get into the notion of just the insane amounts of spending this president is looking to do, we have to understand the underlying condition in this country. Is there unemployment? Yes, there's unemployment. Are there people who are underemployed? Yes, there are people who are underemployed. But it is because of shutdowns brought about by government. Whether that's in business or schools, government officials shut the economy down. Now, we can argue about whether or not it was important to shut the economy down given the pandemic. But the fact of the matter is government did this. This isn't a failure of capitalism. This isn't a failure of free markets. This isn't a failure of Wall Street, the investor class, the individual, the striver, the business owner, the billionaire. The billionaires didn't shut the economy down. Government did that at every level. The county, the state, the federal government pushing for these things. This is a man standing at the dais wanting to throw money out to everybody out there. It's going to be a, well, at first I thought it would be FDR, but really it was a replication of more like the Great Society. Rush reminds us, though, the Great Society wasn't so great.
None of what's happening now is normal. None of what's happening now is anything people would design, including the lockdowns, the shutdowns, the pandemic, the ineffective way of dealing with it, the fake news. All of these public protests, all these malcontents. Look at what we've done. Lyndon Johnson, Civil Rights Act 1964. What have we had? We had the Great Society. We've had the war on poverty. We've had over $4 trillion of wealth transferred from producers, taxpayers, to people who were discriminated against. They're worse off today than they were before all this happened. This is one of Shelby Steele's big points. After all of this supposed help, it's one of my big points too, after all of this help, after all this compassion, after all this assistance provided by the Democrat Party, we've got an angrier population of minorities than we have ever had. And most people in this country do not think they're racist. They think they've gone out of their way to avoid being racists. They've gone out of their way to be accommodating. They've gone out of their way to be sympathetic. It doesn't compute. Most people are asked, what the hell else can I do? Now, if you get into the millennial demographic, they're not old enough to have had this perspective yet. And I have mentioned the past couple of days, and this is true, that the vast majority of violent protests, not all, but the vast majority of violent protests are being conducted by white millennial kids. And in that group, it's a hell of a lot of women. They have been totally, their minds and brains have been totally commandeered. You parents who have kids at college or recently were at college, and have come, you know exactly what I'm talking about. After 2 years there, they come home and they start telling you how you're racist, you're destroying the planet with climate change, you're listening to complaints about your parenting and the way you've run the country that you don't even recognize. But your kids have been indoctrinated to believe that this country is white privileged, it's white supremacy. And the dangerous thing is, I've seen evidence, I've had parents call here to start agreeing with their kids. Their kids are coming home from college and persuading them that they're right. So then when the kids go to Seattle, start burning things down, the parents are proud of them. Other people go, well, what the hell is happening to our country?
Why were they out there protesting last summer, last spring? Why were they out there protesting? Yes, they were protesting against injustice. But why were they destroying property? Because none of them had any place to go. They weren't in college. They weren't in school. They didn't get to go to camp. They didn't get to go party. They were locked down. And what caused the lockdowns? The lockdowns were caused by government, federal, state, local government. Now we're paying people not to go to work. We're paying people not to go to work. We're paying people $1,100 a week or whatever it is. And we're saying, don't take a job. So now you've got unemployed people who are unemployed because Joe Biden is handing out Biden bucks. The only organically unemployed people in the country right now, and I'm exaggerating, but follow me on this, are the victims of the Keystone Pipeline killing that Joe Biden did on day one as president of the United States. He unemployed Keystone jobs. The difference between the Keystone jobs that he killed and the border wall jobs that he killed is we're still paying for the border wall, even if it doesn't get built. All of this, right, the Keystone jobs, all of this in a sacrifice to the Green New Deal. Now he wants to do more of it. He literally wants to do more of it. There's a report that came out earlier today. First quarter GDP, 6.5%. So what you're probably saying is, yay, 6.5% GDP, this is great, the economy's great. In fact, I'm willing to believe there's an amen corner of people who backed President Trump who are saying, see, we knew the Trump economy would work. It's finally coming back. You want to know the real reason why it's 6.5% GDP is the number that was reported out on that first quarter? Because the Biden bucks, the government money is sloshing around. Go try to buy a fence. You can't get lumber. You can't build houses. There's a major shortage of stuff out there. And we're pumping all this money into the economy. So in sum, what did you get last night? A promise to spend $4 trillion of your dollars to pay some of you people not to work, to pay other people not to work, and to expand the size of government to a size that could almost never be fully comprehended and understood. All about the fair share. We'll talk about the fair share straight ahead. Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. Happy to be here with you. So looking back at this speech last night, one of the things that keeps coming up is a term that this president uses, and the progressives all use this term, whether it's a president, whether it's a congressman, whether it's Senator Ossoff from Georgia, whether it's former President Obama, or even former President Bill Clinton. And it's the notion of fair share, the fair share. You have to pay your fair share. The rich have to pay their fair share. Well, how much is the fair share? Well, no, we'll tell you when you've hit the fair share, but you have not hit the fair share yet. This was used a lot when Barack Obama was president. You would hear things like, I'm willing to listen to the Republicans who bring any good ideas this way. It's the notion of using adjectives to validate a competing political opinion. Fair share. Good ideas. Smart policy. Green policy. And what happens is these politicians will adjudicate whether or not you're bringing a good idea, whether or not you've paid the fair share, but they'll never give you a standard. So last night, Joe Biden's calling for the wealthy to pay their fair share.
It's time for corporate America and the wealthiest 1% of Americans to just begin to pay their fair share. Just their fair share.
To begin to pay their fair share. You heard the breakdown from Rush yesterday on the show with Mick Mulvaney explaining how it is all this works. Okay, the wealthiest 1% pay the freight. They pay the freight at state levels in the Northeast, on the West Coast, at the federal level across the country. The top 1% are paying their fair share. Rush talked about this.
John in Cornwall, New York. Hello, sir.
Aloha, Rushy. Gigadiddos to you. Longtime listener and honor to speak with you.
Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate that.
I'm calling because I am fed up with hearing the term paying your fair share.
Amen, bro.
I've had my fair share stolen from me every day in taxes and hidden fees in the last 43 years of my life when I have been working.
Amen. And the top 1% are paying 70% of all the tax revenue anyway. If the game's rigged, that's where it's rigged.
And when are the recipients of my fair share going to pay their fair share?
You know, that is an excellent... Like, these people talk about, you didn't build that. You didn't make that happen. As far as I'm concerned, the people who aren't paying taxes don't get to run around claiming that they built everything, that they built the roads and that they built the bridges and so forth. If it weren't for the taxes of the 1%, the 2%, the 5%, the 10%, then the 89 million people who aren't working wouldn't be eating and making phone calls on their cell phones or watching their plasmas or whatever. Some of this stuff is just backwards. But that's what I mean again by this being Democrat playbook boilerplate. Rich aren't paying their fair share. The poor are getting the shaft. Stuff that we've heard for the last 50 years. And if you're only 30 years old listening to the program for 25, I'm telling you, everything Obama said, like Jimmy Carter said it in 1980, it's almost verbatim. This has been standard operating procedure, word for word practically, what the Democrats have said when they get in trouble for at least 50 years.
From that narrative ought to always be growth, economic growth, wealth is not a zero-sum game. It is not a zero-sum game. Jeff Bezos is worth, what, $120 billion, right? He's worth $120 billion. Did he get his $120 billion by stealing it from poor people? No, he did not. Why? Because poor people do not have $120 billion to steal. The wealthy don't get rich stealing from the poor. You run out of real estate very quickly. The poor have a finite amount of money, and it's not nearly enough to maintain the lavish lifestyles of people with last names like Kerry and Clinton and Obama and Jack Dorsey out in Silicon Valley. Actually, that's not even fair, because Jack Dorsey in Silicon Valley actually has Twitter. He's actually developed Twitter. Obama and the Bidens and the Clintons and the Kerrys, well, see, that's not even really fair for John, well, for John Kerry, but, well, and for Therese Hines Kerry, I guess, because the Kerry fortune, the Hines fortune was accumulated through selling a product. But the point is, they are relying on your ignorance of economics. And I don't mean that to say you're dumb. I mean, they're relying on the public's ignorance of economics to understand how the country works. They think that every time a guy gets a Lamborghini, it means a child has been denied a meal. That's not true at all. The economy in 1790 was of a given size. Let's just say it was worth $1 million, right? Just an arbitrary number. The economy now is trillions and trillions of dollars, right? $25 trillion in a given year. Look at those numbers and tell me where that differential came about. Oh, speculation in Wall Street, stealing from the poor. No, it's not how it works. You trade your labor and you are paid money in exchange for that. In your spare time, you're at your house and you're developing a product that then somebody wants to pay you for. You sell it to them. They think it's great. It gets the attention of an investor group who says, this thing, we could sell this nationwide. And now all of a sudden, instead of selling one of those items, you're selling 50,000 of those items every week. You're getting rich. Are you stealing from people? Only if you're a bank robber or a fraudster like Bernie Madoff or the government confiscating that which is not yours. People have a failure to understand where money comes from. It doesn't come from the government. It doesn't. The government can take it from you, and they will take it from you. But the dirty little secret about all of this is they'll never take it from you and then give it directly to a poor person. There's a middleman called the government, and they parse it out as power and control. Okay, we believe this group of people deserves this money. Why? Are they starving to death? No, we need them to vote for us in this next election, so let's do a wealth transfer. Governor Pat McCrory is running for the Senate seat in North Carolina, and he had a tweet last night after this address, and he said, North Carolina families can't afford the job losses, surging gas prices, and destruction of small businesses that would come if Biden's radical agenda is left unchecked. He's right, and yet when you read Niall Strange in The Hill today, he's praising Joe Biden for sounding so reasonable while talking about spending all of this money. He's going to be awfully hard to defeat if you're a Republican because, well, he doesn't sound like a radical. It's not tone of voice. It's not pounding on the desk. It's not yelling and screaming and waving your arms and laying in a street and blocking traffic. The radical idea is the notion of spending $4 trillion on stuff that the American people are neither clamoring for nor demanding. Remember, just 2 weeks ago, they were telling you child care is infrastructure. Child care is infrastructure? Child care can be used for generations to come by investing in it today? No, that's a road and a bridge. But that was a serious member of the Senate saying that very thing. And yet Niall Strange will say, this guy was really amazing. What a statesman, making the case calmly and concisely. Yeah, he's trying to give you a Santa Claus moment. And he's going to stick it to every small business, new business, medium business, large business, you name it. That's the group of people who have the target on their back. And I want to hear what you have to say about that at 800-282-2882. I have a feeling that you're mighty dissatisfied with what you heard last night. I want to talk about that straight ahead, get your reaction to that as well. And oh, don't worry, don't worry. We'll talk about those vicious attacks on Tim Scott as well. Brett Witterbull, your guide host on the EIB Network. Tim Scott gave the response last night to the president's address there to the joint session of Congress. And Tim Scott, who happens to be, full disclosure, my senator, he is the senator that represents me along with the other senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham. He took some major incoming from people at the Washington Post who were essentially trying to say that the story of his life and his family's hardship isn't as authentic as would be expected. In fact, in the Hill newspaper, commentators blast Washington Post fact check on Tim Scott. An extensive Washington Post fact check on the background of Tim Scott, Senator Tim Scott, Republican, South Carolina, the only black Republican in the Senate, has drawn fire from critics on the left and the right, with some saying it deliberately downplays the hardship Scott's family faced after the Civil War. The story's headline stated, Tim Scott often talks about his grandfather and cotton. There's more to the tale. Tim Scott speaking eloquently on why America is not a racist country.
Hear me clearly. America is not a racist country. It's backwards to fight discrimination with different types of discrimination. And it's wrong to try to use our painful past to dishonestly shut down debates in the present.
After the senator made that statement as part of his response to the president's speech last night, after he made that address, former Obama green jobs czar and CNN commentator Van Jones said this.
He lost a lot of African Americans by the tens of millions when he said America is not a racist nation. Look, you can say that we're getting better. You can say that we've come a long way. But when you look at these numbers, when you look at these statistics, it is very clear that this country is still struggling with racism.
Struggling with racism, but is it a racist country? No, Van, it's the Democrats who are losing African Americans every day, not Tim Scott. You were one for a while. You remember when you praised President Trump for his criminal justice reform? Let's go back to last October and hear that.
Donald Trump, and I get beat up by liberals every time I say this, I'm going to keep saying it. He has done good stuff for the black community. Opportunity zone stuff, black college stuff. I work with him on criminal justice stuff. I saw Donald Trump have African-American people formerly incarcerated in the White House, embraced them, treated them well. There's a side to Donald Trump that I think he does not get enough credit for.
Wow. A moment of truth and clarity. Rush talked about this very challenge. Racist Democrats smearing Tim Scott for doing the job they won't do.
Tim Scott, Republican South Carolina, got very serious after the George Floyd death, the resulting civil unrest, the war on cops. And he attempted to do what everybody in Washington tells us we must do. He attempted to cross the aisle. He attempted to come up with legislation that both parties could support for the good of the country, for the good of the people, to satisfy everybody, to deal with legitimate problems so that they would not happen again. He proposed legislation to fix blue state, Democrat-run cities' police departments. What did the Democrats do? They insulted him, and they blocked the bill. After demanding pretty much everything he put in the bill, they blocked it because it's an election year and they cannot possibly have a Republican, African-American Republican, anywhere near a solution to this because they don't want a solution. They don't want the idea that cops kill black perps solved. They want the issue. So they had Senator Turbin go out there on the floor of the Senate and refer to this as a token piece of legislation. Tim Scott is the only African-American Republican senator. And there's Durbin purposely calling his legislation token, like it's insignificant. He knew what he was doing. He was calling Senator Scott a token. And Senator Scott responded on the floor of the Senate by talking about how that literally hurt him to his soul to be called a token by a fellow United States senator. So the Democrats insult him. They block the bill. And that's how to look at this. Democrat-run cities lead the news most every day. Riots, looting, statue defacement and destruction, boarded up stores, the police under assault, police departments defunded. If there was a real news media, Democrats would be losing by historic landslide numbers in every poll. Their cities are rat and crime-infested hellholes. And those hellholes are being sustained through November. So Republicans, led by a black senator, offered to do the work the Democrats will not do. He offered to reform police departments and to try to begin restoring order to Democrat-run cities under the silly belief that they were interested in restoring order. They aren't. Not right now. The lack of law, the lack of order, all of that is seen as helpful to the agenda of getting rid of Donald Trump. They end up smearing Scott for his efforts. All he did was take them seriously. All he did was afford them the respect that they demand. He believed they really were interested in police reform. He believed after the George Floyd episode that the Democrats really did want something to get fixed so that this kind of stuff would stop.
We're going to be getting more into the racial aspects of the speech in the next hour. And it's an important conversation, especially noting that Senator Scott today is going to be speaking with the Floyd family. He may have already done it this morning, but he is scheduled to speak with George Floyd's family to figure out the pathway forward. As I mentioned a few moments ago, you had in the preface to the speech last night by President Biden, you had him directly reference the notion of the crisis and the opportunity. Unfortunately, for so many who are living in crime-ravaged communities or in communities that are not as safe as they ought to be, and communities that are unfortunately suffering because of this push to de-emphasize policing, to defund policing, to abolish the police, and all of those are mainstream talking points that are coming from people in the squad and beyond in the Democratic Party. The crisis is for the people who are living in those communities, trying to work and protect their families in those communities. And the opportunity at that point becomes very clearly the opportunity for the Democratic Party and for government to come in and take over in that situation, when the reality is bridges need to be built. And those bridges that need to be built between law enforcement and the community are not going to be covered in an infrastructure plan. They would have been covered in Tim Scott's plan to reform policing. We're welcoming another new sponsor to this program. Rush would be happy, particularly because this sponsor, and it's Oxford Gold Group, has really proven themselves with their customer service. Rush measured every sponsor through the lens of how you, his listener, would benefit. Customer service and being trustworthy was key and is key. Oxford Gold Group meets those criteria. If you're worried about your hard-earned dollars becoming worthless or your 401k or IRA losing value, now is the time to consider moving into gold. Don't sit back and watch your savings and retirement accounts suffer. Make your money work as hard for you as you did for your money. Put your savings and retirement accounts into something real, like gold and silver. Real gold and silver you can actually have in your hands. How do you do that? By calling Oxford Gold Group today at 833-404-GOLD. The Oxford Gold Group will teach you everything you need to know about owning real gold and silver. And it's a lot easier than you think. Call the Oxford Gold Group right now at 833-404-GOLD to get your free gold and silver investment guide. And by the way, if you should ever decide to sell your gold or silver, the Oxford Gold Group will buy it back. And they don't charge you anything when you sell your gold and silver to Oxford. Get your free Oxford Gold Group investment guide today and learn how easy it is to have real gold delivered to your home, or how you can have real gold and silver in your retirement account. Call the Oxford Gold Group today at 833-404-GOLD. That's 833-404-GOLD. I'm Brett Witterble, your guide host today on the EIB Network. 800-282-2882 is the phone number to be a part of the conversation. I'm Brett Witterble, your guide host today on the EIB Network. Let's go out and check in with some of the great listeners across the Fruited Plain. Nick is first up in Richmond, Michigan. Hello, Nick. Welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Adults know that what it really means when you get free college for 2 or 4 years or free preschool is that you get the pleasure of paying for everyone else's college for the rest of your life, like some crazy backwards chain letter. And also the janitor gets stuck buying the CEO's degree.
That's a great point. That is a tremendous point, and I love the reference to chain letters because that's exactly what it is. If you just forward these letters, you'll get millions of dollars in your mailbox. So listen, you know full well that you have a very progressive governor there in that state of Michigan, and she was somebody who was rumored to be a vice presidential potential once upon a time. Is she going to try to sell this there inside the state of Michigan? All this free is for me?
She already did. She was already on this morning pushing it as a supposed COVID update.
That's the COVID update. Free junior college, free college for as long as you want. That's the COVID update.
Well, it was pushing everything that was said in the speech yesterday as being, just pushing all that as being good.
I'm not surprised. Nick, such a great point that you raise, and I appreciate you being there. Free stuff is not free. It just means somebody else is going to be delivering the goods. Piper is in Northern California. Piper, welcome to the Rush Limbaugh Show.
Hi, it's from Rush's adopted hometown, and shout out to KFBK and Kitty O'Neill, a friend of his, and the Pat Walsh Show. So this is a great place to be.
So happy to hear from you.
I cannot understand why it didn't raise the hair on people's neck about the numbers that they were throwing out. So perspective is 1 million seconds is 11 days.
Mm-hmm.
1 billion seconds is about 31 years.
Mm-hmm.
And 1 trillion seconds is about 32,000 years. So when they throw around trillion and people don't have the I don't know if it's you just listen and you think trillion, billion, and you don't really think about the difference and
right.
the scale of it.
Right.
Are you kidding me? A trillion, 32,000 years, a trillion seconds. So, intersect that or,
sure.
insert that into our economy. And this is how much we're going to spend in addition to what we've already spent. You're right on about our grandkids and great grandkids and. It makes me crazy.
Except it's not going to be our great-grandkids. It's going to be 35 generations down the line because Joe Biden wants to spend $6 trillion, and that's 192,000 years, which is insane. It is just nuts.
It is insane.
Oh, thanks so much for calling, Piper, and I appreciate you and all our best to the beautiful area, Sacramento, California. Lots of great listeners out there, and we always appreciate hearing from them. Okay, let me go to Minneapolis. Right there in the headlines of the news, Paul is up next. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks, Brett. The groups of people that are yelling the loudest in this country for free stuff are the poor, whether they're working poor or non-working poor. And conversely, the ones who are going to suffer the most under this lunacy are the same groups. What are they going to do when they're told, as poor people, that they have to go buy a $50,000 electric vehicle, or when their electric bill doubles, quadruples, when the price of gas is $4 or $5 a gallon? They're going to be suffering. So you know what? What I say to them is, you get to sit down and shut your big mouth now and deal with the consequences of your actions, because that's something that has escaped the left for decades, consequences. I wanted to use one more example. They
Please.
Interviewed a business owner in downtown Minneapolis a few weeks ago. I think he owned a barbecue joint. And he's sitting there complaining about, because of all the lunacy that's going on in downtown Minneapolis, that 70-75% of his business has been lost because everyone's scared to go down into that area. Well, I saw a picture of the guy as he's talking. And let's just say that statistically speaking, he probably more than likely voted for Democrats, state, local, and federal Democrat politicians. So I'm sitting there scratching my head saying, hold on a sec. No. What you get to do now, partner, is sit down and shut your big Marxist mouth. It's called consequences for your actions, and it's something my three-year-old grandson understands, and they're going to be the ones feeling the pinch the worst.
Okay, I understand. I understand what you're saying there, but I would recommend this as well. This is an important opportunity for people. This is a chance to start to convert people away from this, right? Because they've now gotten 100 days of what this is going to be for the next 4 years. And I think this is a chance, and I think Rush would leap at this chance to say, we're not going to leave this guy out there drowning. This is a chance for him to get saved and to come to the side of free markets and liberty and all of that. Nobody wants to see cities burn, regardless of how they're voting or what they're doing in terms of their politics. We want to see everybody have an opportunity to fulfill the promise and the dream of the great American experience. At least that's what I think. You know what? Let me tell you this real quick. If you're a podcast listener, there's a new forthcoming podcast series that you're going to want to subscribe to. Everybody's going to want to subscribe to this. It's hosted and narrated by our own James Golden, who worked alongside Rush for nearly all of Rush's 33 years of hosting this program. I'll let him describe this incredible podcast series in the making.
James Golden here, a.k.a. Bo Snerdly. I'm hosting a new podcast series, Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the Golden EIB microphone. It's a behind-the-scenes look at the man who brought us all together and kept us together for more than three decades, Rush himself. We start May 12th on iHeart or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, presented by the Tunnel to Towers Foundation and MyPillow.
So looking forward to it. I'm Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. So just a little pop trivia question for everyone. Today's EIB High Note at the end of the show is going to make mention of Rush's favorite bird. Can you guess what it's going to be? No, it's not Robert Bird. Stop that. It's a bird. It's a type of bird. We'll be talking about that in the EIB High Note at the end of the program. I love an analogy that I heard recently about what Joe Biden wants to try to do to redistribute wealth, right? So imagine a balloon has been fully inflated. What Joe Biden intends to do, the fully inflated balloon is the economy. What Joe Biden intends to do is to go over to that balloon and deflate that balloon and then take that air in his hands and hand it to the poor people who need to be redistributed to. I know it sounds goofy, right? It won't work. Redistribution never works. Rich people will take their money, kind of put it in hiding, ride this thing out, and wait for the future. I'm Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. Wonderful to be here. Hour two of the Rush Limbaugh Show now underway. Our phone number, 800-282-2882. Happy to be here with you. One big component of the speech last night was obviously the discussion of the spending and the taxes and the fiscal transformation that President Biden and Vice President Harris are seeking to do in this country. But another big one was certainly the role of identity politics and those considerations, especially vis-a-vis a discussion on race and the contention by President Joe Biden and Vice President Harris that America is a systemically racist nation. Now, this is fraught with a challenge here in terms of the conversation for a number of reasons. First of all, Tim Scott offered the rebuttal to the Biden address last night, to the president's address last night. And within moments of him offering a rebuttal, he was the recipient of slurs and invective, especially out on Twitter. People were using all kinds of horrible language describing a sitting senator in the United States Senate. One ugly term that was being used to describe him was Uncle Tim, a play on the phrase of Uncle Tom. And it got very ugly out there in the social media, as it always does. I mean, we know what social media is. It's the lowest common denominator of people who feel no compunction saying things about each other that they would never say in person to another human being. But Tim, you know, the senator, Tim Scott, did a tremendous job with that speech, laying out his contentions, his solutions. And why do I say this conversation is fraught with risk? Well, it's not fraught with risk by us or we, the folks who are sitting here talking and debating and discussing, because you are able to call a radio show and express your opinion. That's the genius and the beauty of what Rush built here with this program. And none of the cable news media outlets, none of the TV news anchors, none of the bloggers, the morning shows that you see are going to take your phone call. They're just going to tell you what you need to think and ignore your reaction to that. But we take phone calls here, and that's the hallmark of an open and healthy conversation. So where's the risk? The risk is actually with the president of the United States. The risk is with President Biden. Let me let you hear what it was that President Biden said last night on rooting out systemic racism.
We have a giant opportunity to bend the arc of the moral universe toward justice, real justice. And with the plans outlined tonight, we have a real chance to root out systemic racism that plagues America and American lives in other ways.
Joe Biden has been a part of the body politic, with the exception of the last 4 years before he was elected to the presidency. He's been a part of the body politic since 1972. He has had a role in the direction of the United States of America, and a profound one at that, as one of the most influential senators in government and a sitting vice president of the United States. So if America is suffering from systemic racism, one would wonder what you did to do away with that over your years in the Senate and in the vice presidency. Tim Scott, Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina, said race is not a political weapon.
The president absurdly claims that this is worse than Jim Crow. What is going on here? I'll tell you, a Washington power grab. This misplaced outrage is supposed to justify Democrats' new sweeping bill that would take over elections for all 50 states. It would send public funds to political campaigns you disagree with and make the bipartisan Federal Elections Commission partisan. This is not about civil rights or our racial past. It's about rigging elections in the future. And no, the same filibuster that President Obama and President Biden praised when they were senators, the same filibuster that the Democrats used to kill my police reform bill last year, has not suddenly become a racist relic just because the shoe is now on the other foot. Race is not a political weapon to settle every issue the way one side wants.
It's a profound layout by Senator Scott in a very reasoned way. The idea that the system is racist and you are now going to turn over the elections to the national government, to the federal government, to dictate terms to the 50 states, says what about those elections? When a sitting president declares that this law coming out of Georgia is Jim Crow Part 2? What's going on here? It's because it's being used as an attack. Rush spoke about this and spoke about America being under attack from within.
If enough Americans can be persuaded of all of that, that America is inherently racist, that America is and has been a lie, then it's over. And that is the objective, and we are in the midst of it. Sometimes you're so close to the forest you don't see the trees. That's what we are in the midst of here, an ongoing effort to erase America by discrediting the entire premise, our culture, our history, our founding. The objective is to create in as many American minds as possible that America as founded is not worth defending. Serious times. This is a very, very serious effort that's underway. Sadly, it has a lot of allies. It has a lot of people helping it that ought to be opposing it, but they are choosing what they think is the path of least resistance, which is defined by the media. You've got several Republicans who I believe are unwittingly participating in the effort to cast America as indefensible, particularly with Donald Trump as president. Trump as president is, in their view, the attacks on Trump, the characterization of his presidency is designed to show how really flawed America is. That somebody like this could be elected, that means it's time to get rid of the Constitution. That means it's time to get a whatever made Trump possible, it's time to change it and get rid of it. This is very, very serious stuff happening here. And it has the aid and support of the media, which means it has the aid and support of the worldwide left and the Democrat Party. America's profound morality, kindness, widespread prosperity, and design for equal opportunity should be self-evident. But that assumes that factual, historically accurate reporting and education is taking place, and we know that it isn't. It is a shame and a near crime that the profound morality and greatness and kindness and widespread prosperity and equal opportunity that is America isn't known. It is a crime that those characteristics of our country are in the process of being recast and erased. We are getting hysterically inaccurate reporting. We have been in the midst of hysterically inaccurate education for generations. America is unique. America copied no other country. Every other country was a copycat of others, with governments that denied individual freedom, denied opportunity, denied sovereignty. That's what was copied. Tyranny was copied, nation to nation, people to people. That is the history of humanity. Living in tyranny, living under authoritarianism, living in poverty, living in sickness, until the United States came along, which copied nothing. The United States and its founders rejected all of that tyranny, oppression, poverty. In America, the individual was the supreme power. That is being erased under the premise that the individual is corrupt. The individual is likely a racist or a transphobe or a homophobe or some other ill-prepared sack of humanity. And so we need to overcome the corruption that is the individual. That incomparable embrace of humanity that is the United States of America. There's no place on this planet that human beings would rather be than the United States of America. And yet, people born and raised in this country have been persuaded that America is a sinkhole, a hellhole, a sewer, a garbage dump, or a dungeon, and are in the process of actually creating all of that under the guise of civil rights, equality, and liberty. The incomparable embrace of humanity that is the United States is under attack. Leftists, Democrats, seek control over 100% of the population. They accomplish this with lies, such as the Affordable Health Care Act. They accomplish it with one lie after another. The lies being told today are the lies designed to convince people their country is not worth maintaining as it is. Their country is not worth maintaining as founded because it was founded as racist, sexist, bigot, and homophobic. You know the drill. Immoral and illegitimate. Ignorant people will not remain free for very long. The media is working on a path parallel with school systems to actively and passively distort information, to wipe out from the vestiges of our history and our memory any collection of stories that testify to the greatness of America and her people.
And they'll call it the new curriculum to educate your kids in a better way. I'm Brett Winterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. And I am Brett Winterbull, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Happy to be here. Happy to be spending this time with you. Green jobs. Oh, climate change, jobs. President Biden last night at the Capitol said, when I think of climate change, I think of jobs.
For too long, we've failed to use the most important word when it comes to meeting the climate crisis. Jobs. For me, When I think climate change, I think jobs.
Come on, Mr. President. You think of jobs when you think of climate change? You weren't thinking of jobs when you killed the Keystone XL pipeline. Here's Rush on the regime's lies on green jobs.
Yesterday in Washington, during a House Government Oversight Reform Committee, it's Darrell Issa's committee, there was a hearing on the Labor Department's jobs report. The acting commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, a guy named John Galvin, testified, and there was a Q&A, and we put together a montage here of Darrell Issa and Galvin. They're having a conversation about green jobs. Now, what's interesting here, this is a regime hack from the Labor Department defining what a green job is. Now, keep in mind, the regime is pushing green energy, green sector. They want you to believe that there's a future in green jobs and that they're out there creating a bunch of green jobs. So what Issa did, he went through the BLS report, and he was astounded when he found out what the regime is counting as green jobs. And that's what the Q&A is all about.
If you sweep the floor in a solar panel facility, is that a green job?
Yes.
If you drive a hybrid bus, public transportation, is that a green job?
According to our definition, yes.
What about just any school bus driver?
Yes.
What about the guy who puts gas in the school bus?
Yes.
How about employees at a bicycle shop?
I guess I'm not sure about that.
The answer is yes, according to your definition. What about someone who works at an antique dealer?
I'm not sure about that either.
The answer is yes, those are recycled goods. What about someone who works at the Salvation Army in their clothing recycling and furniture?
Right, because they're selling recycled goods.
What about workers at a consignment shop?
That's a green job.
Does the teenage kid who works full-time at a used record shop count?
Yes.
Do garbage men have green jobs?
Yes.
How about an oil lobbyist? Wouldn't an oil lobbyist count as having a green job if they are engaged in advocacy related to environmental issues?
Yes.
Thank you.
Green jobs. That's how they're counting them. Darrell Issa talking to John Galvin, Bureau of Labor Statistics. That's the next time you hear him talk about how great green job creation is. You now know includes kids at bicycle shops and used record shops.
This is the problem with the Green New Deal and the idea of green jobs. You don't have to deliver the goods, as you just heard. You don't have to deliver any of the goods, any of the goods. You just have to be aspirational. And if you're working really hard, right? Remember that you hear these phrases come up from time to time. Bill Clinton would talk about, I'm working so hard to do this. I'm working so hard to do that. You don't understand how hard I'm working to do this and do that. You also hear it from politicians who run and they say, we're going to pay for this with waste, fraud, and abuse. We're going to work the waste, the fraud, and abuse out of the system. That means nothing. Green jobs are nothing. They're not. They're important. And if they're successful, they'll materialize in a free marketplace. But for what government is looking to do with these green jobs, they're looking and they're pushing and they're trying to make it look like they can competently deploy an entire sector of business by government fiat. And that is insane. That is loony. Let's go out on the phones and talk to Victor in Silver Springs, Maryland. Victor, welcome to the program.
Thank you. About a couple of years ago, when I was making money hand over fist, I took advantage of all the money I was making and really did some home improvements, new roof, siding, windows, etc. Now, if somebody comes to me and says, well, what about this or what about that? I'll say, well, I'd like to, but because rich people like me are going to get hit with high taxes, I won't be able to afford your services anymore. And speaking of green, the electric car is the worst thing that could happen to the blind. They don't make any noise. Oh. I almost got hit 3 or 4 times because I couldn't hear the car coming as I was crossing the street.
That's an important note on the dangers of electric cars. That's true. But let me take the occasion of your call, and I appreciate you calling in today, Victor. Thank you so much. Let me take the occasion of your call to point out something else. We keep hearing about the 500,000 charging stations that are going to be put up around the country. First of all, these things are going to be eyesores. Second of all, people are not acclimated to driving a certain amount of distance than having to sit there for a half an hour or an hour or an hour and a half to recharge the cars. That's the problem with the Green New Deal. The country needs an education on taxes. The country needs an education on aspiration and legitimate expectation. What you have in the case of the sales pitch last night is a whole lot of aspiration, hoping that we never show up with any real expectation of this stuff manifesting as a real legitimate option. Bruce is in Milwaukee. He wants to talk about Tim Scott's speech. Bruce, welcome to the program on the IB Network.
Such an honor. I wish I could have got through when Rush was still with us. But
I
God
do too.
Bless him and everything he's done. But Senator Scott, he had a wonderful rebuttal speech. And my question to you, I'll just keep this quick and short. Why has the African community as a whole been, I mean, they've been lied to for 200 years by the Democrats. I mean, the Democrats brought the slaves over, and I could go on and go on through the history of what the Democrats have done to repress the African-American community. Why is the African community continue to vote for a Democratic Party that really they're racist towards?
Well,
that's my question. I appreciate the answer.
Okay, Bruce. I appreciate it. Thank you for calling in today. We have to be cautious. We have to be cautious and understand that we can't define behavioral patterns just by groups alone, okay? We can't say, well, those people vote this way. You can say that there are places, pockets, locations in this country where the Democrats have a stranglehold or a hammerhold or a toehold on what it is that they want to do. They have the machinery in place to keep people voting for them. But again, nothing is set in stone. Nothing is set in stone ever in politics. It's an ebb and a flow. There was a time when the Republicans couldn't get any people of color voting for them in the last number of years. Right. Romney wasn't very successful at it. McCain had challenges at it. Donald Trump actually was quite successful in a lot of different ways. You can't write off communities. It's about selling the message of prosperity. It's about selling the message of freedom. Rush talked about it endlessly. We'll talk about it some more straight ahead. I'm Brett Winterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network, and I'm looking forward to taking your phone calls and your thoughts on the speech. Thank you, Johnny Donovan. You know, as I look back at the speech last night by the president and, of course, the speech by Tim Scott in response, I'm seeing a common theme play out both on social media. I'm seeing a common theme play out in my email personally with my circle of people that I talk to. And the question is really brilliantly surmised by Jackson in Jackson, Texas. Jackson, welcome to the program. Princeton, Texas. Jackson in Princeton, Texas, welcome to the program. What is your concern with the speech last night with Tim Scott?
Basically, I felt that Tim Scott, I mean, he had some good points, but I felt he was a bit too passive. When I think of Biden, I think of Biden as a president of the Democrat Party rather than of America.
Mm-hmm.
This is just evidenced by all of his executive orders and partisan policy decisions. It's just rampant. So when he says that America is on the move last night, is he talking about all of us in America or is he talking about the Democrats? Now, with my issue with Tim Scott last night is that I think he missed that mark. I think that the Republicans are only seeing this as, Socratic policy debate rather than noticing that the Democrats are playing for keeps. I don't think that he really laid out a good game plan for the Republicans and their base on engaging and actively pursuing ways to secure our civil liberties and, honestly, just get us back to the America that we knew. All these mm-hmm. mask mandates here and there, it's I see tyranny everywhere, but.
Okay,
that's
so let me
about his speech last night.
So let me ask you about this, Jackson. So if I were to say, give me, and I'm just putting you on the spot here quickly, give me somebody you would have liked to have seen in that seat instead of him, in terms of a stylistic approach or a speaking style or something. Who would you have envisioned being in that seat?
I can't give a name,
sure.
But what I would have liked to hear more of is, when we see bills like H.R. 1, I mean, why aren't we attacking that head on? That is just I don't see that as safe and secure election reform. I see that as a blanket, right. Like, hey, let's redo 2020 again.
Sure.
And it's just, it's one of those things where I feel that if he had specifically said something along the lines of, hey, this is our own self-sufficiency plan, like, you know, and give, you know, an actual infrastructure plan rather than just blanket everything. Hey, let's just throw money at this program and throw money at that program. It's actually engaging and seeing how they can help the overall American people rather than have all these ideologies being pushed into different programs.
Okay, look, it's a fair take. I've gotten this from people in my own private circle, okay? People who have said, it was a little, he didn't come in and really go for it hard at Biden's positions and things like that. Jackson, I appreciate that phone call very, very much. And there are people who feel that way, and maybe you feel that way. Maybe you want to see a more aggressive approach towards rebutting what it is that the President Biden was offering up and is offering up on a day-to-day basis. Maybe that's what you're looking for. I would invite you to be a part of the conversation at 800-282-2882. Mike, I want to go back to a clip from the beginning of this hour, the Tim Scott clip on race is not a political weapon, because what's interesting to me on Jackson's call is this idea that Tim Scott didn't address that challenge. In reality, he kind of did. This is Tim Scott. Race is not a political weapon.
The president absurdly claims that this is worse than Jim Crow. What is going on here? I'll tell you. A Washington power grab. This misplaced outrage is supposed to justify Democrats' new sweeping bill that would take over elections for all 50 states. It would send public funds to political campaigns you disagree with and make the bipartisan Federal Elections Commission partisan. This is not about civil rights or our racial past. It's about rigging elections in the future. And no, the same filibuster that President Obama and President Biden praised when they were senators, the same filibuster that the Democrats used to kill my police reform bill last year, has not suddenly become a racist relic just because the shoe is now on the other foot. Race is not a political weapon to settle every issue the way one side wants.
That is a mainstream position, I think, in the Republican Party, what he just laid out there. And Republicans have been very aggressive in challenging H.R. 1 because of what it represents, nationalization of elections. And they're calling it, they're putting it under the guise of civil rights, and they're putting it under the guise of important reforms. But if we're upset about who it was that delivered that message, that in its own is a challenge. And let's be clear, the two people who were at the forefront of selecting the rebuttal speech to President Biden were Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell in the Senate and Kevin McCarthy the House Minority Leader in the House of Representatives. But there's Tim Scott talking about H.R. 1, saying it's not the right answer, saying it's not Jim Crow, saying it's a legitimate bill, condemning what it was the Democrats did to him when he tried a police reform bill, where you now have a different approach happening. This is a big challenge all the way around, because what Joe Biden said at the beginning of that speech last night, the very beginning, I'm not talking crisis and opportunity. He said we were facing three incredible challenges as a country: the pandemic, the economic impact of the pandemic, and the worst attack on American democracy since the Civil War. What he was referring to was what happened on January the 6th. It's interesting to me that in the minds of Joe Biden and the Democratic caucus gathered and assembled there in the House chamber, that what took place on January the 6th surpasses September the 11th, in which, let's not forget, the Capitol specifically was targeted by aircraft that went down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. I mean, I don't want to divide and subdivide, but the idea that we're pulling troops out of Afghanistan, we've spent trillions of dollars in the war on terror, and oh, by the way, the Pentagon, the Twin Towers, Shanksville, Pennsylvania, were all the result and the byproduct of that first attack on American democracy. The worst attack since Pearl Harbor. And Pearl Harbor was the worst attack since, I guess you'd have to go back to the Civil War or the War of 1812. So it's interesting the way the orientations are of the political players here. I believe that there was strategery, to borrow a phrase from Rush and in the show Once Upon a Time. I believe there was strategery here because they could have sent out Jim Jordan. They could have sent out somebody else, Josh Hawley, whomever, Ted Cruz. And I do believe that Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy wanted to send out somebody who wasn't then going to become the lightning rod that Joe Biden needed to be the lightning rod today. Now, I'm not saying that that's the smart move. I'm not saying that's the smart money. I'm just saying I think that's what the strategy was with those two men selecting Tim Scott. I think with what Tim Scott had to work with there, he made a brave stand and a strong stand in defense in a big way of where we are. But we certainly can take your phone calls about this. Folks, we are looking at a wholesale takeover of our capital. Capital meaning money and value, not the capital. But we are seeing a wholesale takeover of our capital, of our dreams, of our privacy, of our promises, of our futures, and we've got to fight for this. We absolutely have to fight for this. I mean, it's hard getting all those people together in the Capitol building. It's hard enough to get everyone in the same family to agree on one thing. Now, multiply that by 1 million families. What one thing can a million families agree upon? How about this? Using the services of our longtime sponsor, Legacy Box, to digitally transfer all their videotapes and family films so they can be seen again. Rush was all about this company from the moment he learned of their use of technology to make something possible. Listen in.
You know, the best thing to a family reunion, next best thing, is a way of staying in touch with family members and finding ways to share the good memories if you don't do a reunion. And let's face it, a lot of people don't do reunions, but you can still pull it off by transferring data from family members. Information, pictures, videos, stuff that families have not seen in decades because the media to watch them no longer exists, like Betamax or VHS or Super 8 film or what have you. Now, one of the reasons that our friends at Legacy Box are having such a banner year is that people are discovering all these old memories and they want to be able to see them again. Legacy Box is the company that transfers and digitizes family memories on videotape and film onto computer files, DVDs, thumb drives, however you want it, so they can be watched again, so they can be shared again and revisited over and over. Legacy Box has done this now for more than a million families, and they can do it for your family as well. It just takes a couple of weeks. You start by getting hold of Legacy Box and tell them that you want them to send you a Legacy Box. It's specially made. It's shielded so that whatever you put in it will not be damaged. Once that arrives at your home, you load it up with all the old media that you've got, VHS or Betamax, cassette, Super 8 film, slide projector, pictures, whatever you've got, and send it back to them. And then they start the digitization process. It's one of the best things that you can do for your family, for yourself, a gift that will be meaningful for years to come. Because you haven't seen this stuff in how many decades? How many years? LegacyBox.com/Rush is the website. And that will get you 50% off if you use it today. That's LegacyBox.com/Rush.
I'm Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Looking at that speech last night, you noticed it was a mostly empty Congress, right? It was a mostly empty Congress. It looked like one of Biden's car rallies last year when he spoke to a mostly empty parking lot once upon a time. After a year of campaigning like this, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if Biden prefers to talk to an empty house. Here's Rush's take on those famous Biden car rallies.
You know, we sit here and we constantly make fun of plugs for not doing any rallies, for nobody showing up at plugs' rallies. We make fun of him. We laugh at him. In fact, plugs did a rally at a drive-in movie theater recently. 30 cars showed up. And Plugs did his little rally out there. Yeah, laugh at it while you envision it. 30 cars show up at a drive-in movie theater with Plugs doing some kind of a rally. And we joked that he does these things, and we joked that he couldn't pull off a rally, that if he actually had one, nobody would show up. And that's why he doesn't do them. We say things like Biden doesn't hold political rallies. He has socially distanced functions. Here it is. Biden speaks to 30 cars of supporters at Ohio drive-in rally. Democrat nominee Joe Biden delivered a speech in front of around 30 socially distanced cars of supporters at a drive-in rally Monday night, a warring event with Vice President Pence, who was also in Ohio. Biden gave remarks on the economy in front of United Auto Workers in a half-empty Toledo parking lot. I take it back, it wasn't even a drive-in theater. It was a parking lot. Pence, on the other hand, was speaking to hundreds of supporters in the capital of Columbus. Biden's 25-minute speech to the cars was at times derailed by supporters of Trump, who stood on a nearby street corner and loudly chanted for more. In fact, there were more Trump supporters at Plugs' car rally than there were Biden supporters.
And I know people are asking the question, having seen those car rallies, how'd he pull it off? How'd he do it? Well, he was triple masked, right? He was probably triple masked while he was out there in front of the socially distanced cars, making the case for the votes there in the half-empty parking lot in Toledo. But looking at him present there on the dais in the House of Representatives, speaking in front of about 200 people assembled, you know, a typical State of the Union address, a big one, like the one that Rush received Medal of Freedom at. You'll have like 1,500 people in that chamber. But these 200 people that were in the chamber yesterday, last night, are all vaccinated. They're vaccinated and they're wearing masks at the same time in this chamber while they're socially distanced. I wonder sometimes, I do, I wonder if the people in Congress who are in there in that chamber and wearing the mask, if it is somehow, at least on the side of the Democratic end of the aisle, I wonder if those masks are being treated like Donald Trump's MAGA hats. We're going to wear the mask to show that we're still part of this movement to keep people masked, even outside running at a track meet in Oregon in an 800-meter race causing a teenage girl to collapse at the end for lack of oxygen. I just wonder about that. I wonder if it's now at this point. They've all been vaccinated. They're all socially distanced. They sat there through the proceedings of the trial of President Trump afterwards, and still they want to show that they're still, we are the masked. We are the mask supporters. In so many ways, my radio broadcast career started right here with this program. There was a moment in time when I answered your calls to this program. It's true. But it was James Golden who did that for so many of the years that Rush was behind this microphone. James is now taking his turn behind the microphone in a new podcast series, and here he is to tell you about it.
James Golden here, a.k.a. Bo Snerdly. I'm hosting a new podcast series, Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the Golden EIB microphone. It's a behind-the-scenes look at the man who brought us all together and kept us together for more than three decades. Rush himself. We start May 12th on iHeart or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Presented by MyPillow and the Tunnel to Towers Foundation.
And make sure you get it. It's going to be phenomenal. I'm Brett Witterbull right here on the EIB Network. So taking a look at Vice President Harris last night, her main portfolio issue was raised with about an hour into the speech. And that portfolio issue that was raised with her was, of course, the notion of the border and how it is she's supposed to be responsible for the border. Except she's not responsible for the border, even though you heard President Biden say she was responsible for the border. Well, the fact of the matter is, President Biden did deputize her and say he wanted her to handle the issues at the border with the surge and the flows of migrants. And then they redefined it in real time last night during the speech to saying she's handling border diplomacy with the Golden Triangle countries, right? The Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador, and of course Honduras and Guatemala. So she's been redefined. She's going to handle diplomacy there, and at some point she'll be doing some diplomatic stuff. But there is a fascinating piece that's been dropped by Liz Peek, and I want to dive into this a little bit, because essentially the speculation is that when she was handed that issue, that border crisis issue that is a man-made disaster made by a man named Joe Biden, well, her future in politics is basically doomed. We got details straight ahead. I'm Brett Winterbull on the EIB Network. It really is the fastest 3 hours in media. It's incredible. We are hour three underway, and I am Brett Winterbull. Great to be here. 1-800-282-2882. 800-282-2882. Border crisis torches Kamala Harris's presidential prospects. It's a piece running in The Hill from Liz Peek, who's an opinion contributor. And Liz Peek, who many of you know from appearances on Fox and Fox Business and other channels like that. Liz Peek says in this column, starting it out this way, the odds of Kamala Harris ever being elected president are shrinking faster than a creamsicle in August. As she likely anticipated, tying her to the border disaster was almost sure to be a losing proposition for the vice president. We all know what's happening. We'll be getting new numbers for April crossings just in the next day or so. So we'll find out what's going on. Remember, it started out with 70,000 crossing in February, and then it was 160,000 who crossed the border in March. And now we're going to get those April numbers, and I guarantee you those numbers are going to be through the roof. These could easily be north of 300,000 migrants coming up from Central America, and every one of them brought to the United States border by the executive order signed on day one of the administration by one Joseph R. Biden, president of the United States. I mean, they came up pre-prepared with the Biden T-shirts. They had the Biden T-shirts, and they had the signs pre-printed that said, Biden, let us in. So what happens? Once this crisis gets underway, you have a situation in which the Biden inner circle decides, we're going to give Kamala Harris, we're going to give her the border as her portfolio. Liz Peek writes, saddling her with the border fiasco not only put her at risk politically, and especially in a toss-up border state like Arizona, but added insult to injury since her boss denied her the job she wanted. What was that job? Overseeing the monster $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. After all, she apparently argued, managing the $800 billion stimulus plan is what then Vice President Biden did in 2009 for President Obama. Why didn't she get to star in the greatest Democratic giveaway of all time? Imagine the glory of handing out, this is Liz Peek, $123 billion to K-12 schools, a.k.a. the teachers' unions, no strings attached, or sending tens of millions of dollars to environmental justice grants, which will surely be guided by wildly discretionary assessments, or $362 billion to fiscally parched cities and states, all of which will come knocking to her door. Imagine being on the giving end of $1,400 checks going to 85% of all Americans employed or unemployed. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a dream job. Now she's in charge of chaos at the border. She hasn't gone to the border. She won't go to the border. She says now, because it's been co-signed last night by President Biden, that she's going to do diplomacy at the border instead. She's in charge of border diplomacy now. Not the border diplomacy, meaning she's going to get to meet with leaders of other countries, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras. She had a conversation with President of Mexico, López Obrador. They call him AMLO, to talk about planting trees to help fight climate change. I mean, it's really incredible, but this thing doesn't turn out well. This doesn't turn out well at all for Kamala Harris, because the damage is done. She will forever be tied to this. If she decides she wants to go out and run on her own, she's going to have to face the uncomfortable questions from the press. Oh, who am I kidding? The press isn't going to ask her any uncomfortable questions, but she's going to be asked the uncomfortable questions along those border states. Because as the polling indicates, where Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are most underwater when it comes to Hispanic voters, to Latino and Hispanic voters, is border security. They don't like seeing this influx of people coming into the country. And then you have the administration being sneaky about where they're putting them. They're putting them on buses. They're putting them on planes. They're sending them into the interior of the United States. And how many are bringing COVID? All of that will be pointed right back to the vice president of the United States. She wanted to be in the money distribution business. Instead, she's going to be in the border blame business on the receiving end. Rush talked about how it was Trump was quietly winning big at the border when he was president.
From the Issues and Insight website, editorial board, Trump is quietly winning big at the border. And it's true. I don't know if you've noticed, there's so many other things going on, but have you seen there aren't any caravans? There aren't any massive numbers anymore of people traveling from El Salvador and Guatemala up to Mexico, demanding asylum, demanding amnesty, demanding to be, they're just down. The caravans didn't work. And I am certain they were put up jobs. They were bought and paid for by Democrat donors. I have no doubt about this. But the administration has been very quiet in beating its chest over this success, because the number of people trying to get into the country illegally is way, way down. And it's fascinating because Trump made a big deal out of building the wall. Mexico was going to pay for the wall, but there was going to be a wall. Well, there isn't a wall, and yet there may as well be one. There may as well be a virtual wall, because something is preventing massive illegal immigration. It has really dipped. So the Democrats block Trump from doing the wall. He finds a workaround that's probably more effective and cost less, and it's called enforcing the law. The one thing people do not understand about those of us who oppose illegal immigration has nothing to do with race, has nothing to do with skin color, has nothing to do with economics, nothing whatsoever to do with any of that. It has to do with two things, maybe three. One, the rule of law. It's simply illegal. The other, well, the second thing is the damage to the culture. There is no assimilation on the part of most people coming into the country illegally. As such, it represents an assault on a distinct and unique American culture, which is fundamentally responsible for America's status in the world and the greatness of the American experiment, the American standard of living, American lifestyles. Preserving this distinct American culture is nothing. There's nothing racist about it. There's nothing bigoted about it. It's based on love. And of course, the third thing is the Democrats see this as a massive voter registration drive. And that's another reason why we oppose it. It has nothing to do with the left's usual assault. You just don't like brown-skinned people. You just don't like people from... You don't like people who don't speak English. It has nothing to do with any of that. That's not why illegal immigration is opposed. It's against the law, number one. The rule of law counts for something. If we're not going to enforce that law, then what other laws are we not going to enforce down the road? Anyway, it is a big story, details of which will come up, but Trump is quietly winning big at the border. And I'll tell you something else is health care. Health, you know how health care is revitalizing this country? Not just in terms of health care, but the way the administration is dealing with the health care industry as a job creator. You realize that health care companies are, many of them are causing revitalizations of American urban areas. And it's a big secret, nobody much talking about it. But it's a big deal. And a lot of this stuff is going on under the radar because impeachment and the coup and other things are occupying everybody's attention. While all that's going on, the Trump administration is busy accomplishing serious things.
And let's not forget, you have, from the prior administration, the Trump administration, to now with President Biden, you have an a direct A-B comparison on the border. For 30 years, right? That's the narrative you get from Joe Biden. For 30 years, they can't control. Nobody can fix the border. The border can't be fixed. It can't be done. Well, no, the border could have gotten fixed when Ronald Reagan did the deal in 1986, when Joe Biden was in the Senate, by the way, the Simpson-Mazzoli bill. But the Democrats refused to actually do enforcement on that sort of stuff. They just wanted the amnesty. The rest of it could go pound sand. So what do you have now? What's the situation happening now at the border? The border now is chaotic, right? You're going to have a million people in here by the end of the year, right? The border is chaotic. What was it under Trump? It was managed. It was controlled. You had agreements with the Mexican government. The Mexican government does not want migrants coming up through their countries, not during a COVID crisis. That's what they've got right now, courtesy of the Biden-Harris administration. Let me posit one other thing very quickly before we head into the break. Did you find it curious last night as you were listening to the speech from the president that he seemed to turn more ire on the Republicans than he did on Xi Jinping? He seemed to just once again dismiss the leader of the Communist Party of China, Xi Jinping, the guy who aggressively prevented us from getting the full story on coronavirus at a minimum. And he still calls him you guys are just a competitor. Who are the other competitors in the world for the United States? If China's a competitor, who are the other competitors? North Korea? Iran? Who are the other competitors? He reserves the softest language for Xi Jinping for some reason. Can't quite figure out why that is. Just says, hey, they're competition for us. That's all we are. And allows the border to continue to be bedraggled. It's unbelievable. We have a humdinger of a soundbite straight ahead. Plus, we'll take your phone calls as well. I'm Brett Witterbull. I'm your guide host today on the EIB Network. And I am Brett Witterbull. I am your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. So we've got a little bit of, what's the word I'm looking for here? A little bit of self-editing taking place with the Vice President of the United States. This morning on Good Morning America, co-host George Stephanopoulos was talking to the Vice President, Kamala Harris. And they were talking about, you know, all these issues that are right up front and center and out there. And essentially the issues of racism and America being a racist country came up. And this was the answer from the Vice President Kamala Harris earlier today on Good Morning America.
First of all, no, I don't think America is a racist country, but we also do have to speak truth about the history of racism in our country and its existence today.
Okay, wait. So she doesn't think America is a racist country, but we do have to speak truth about the history of racism in our country and its experience today. That was in response to the question that George Stephanopoulos asked, which was, you know, Senator Tim Scott said last night that America is not a racist nation. Do you agree with that? And that's her response. Well, this sort of stands in contrast to President Biden last night talking about the systemic racism of America. This is the clip we played earlier in the program.
We have a giant opportunity to bend the arc of the moral universe toward justice, real justice. And with the plans outlined tonight, we have a real chance to root out systemic racism that plagues America and American lives in other ways.
This is going to be a challenge for the administration because now we're getting into measures of degree. Measures of degree with the amount of racism that exists in America or the amount of racism that America suffers from or the amount of racist culture or what have you is present in America right now. And no, I'm not joking about this. I'm saying this is fraught with danger because they are on the record. The two of them are on the record speaking extensively about this a little over a week ago when the Floyd verdict came in. And Joe Biden declared that America was a racist country. And then the Vice President Harris amplified his point. So now you have last night, President Biden referencing that again, Tim Scott, the senator from South Carolina, denying that America is a racist country. And now you have Vice President Harris this morning on Good Morning America saying, yeah, I don't think America is a racist country. Play me the Kamala Harris clip again here, Mike. Go.
Racist country, but we also do have to speak truth about the history of racism in our country and its existence today.
This is an interesting little hedging, because we have to speak about the history of racism in our country, comma, and its existence today. Its existence today is racism, or the existence today of the country. I'm going to take it to mean that she means racism. But so it becomes a discussion of degrees. Remember, last night, President Biden also spoke about the men and women of law enforcement in this country and did not write them off as entirely racist. What this means is they're starting to see deterioration in poll numbers. They're starting to see that there's separation on the public safety message, on the message of unity that he ran on. And all those sorts of things, that combined with a border crisis and a stalled agenda, if he's not able to pack the court, bring two states to become part of the union, and of course spend $6 trillion, this could be a disaster for this administration with an eye towards 2022. Let's check in with the phones. Sal in Malvern, Pennsylvania. Sal, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Brett, first I might thank you for carrying the torch for the EAB network. I got a comment and I got a question.
Yes, sir.
I'm an engineer. Facts are my life. That's how I make decisions. They're black and white, no pun intended. And I've written many things and convinced many people with just the facts, keeping the rhetoric out, a la the way I was inspired by the Ross Perot of a bygone era. Why isn't the messaging on any sane person on the right something like that? Just put up a chart, put up a little thing with a couple of darted points and say, here are the facts, and just cut through the nonsense and maybe get to the American people. What's your opinion?
Okay, so here's my opinion. How do you mean present those facts? Like, how do you mean present facts to people?
So simply put, I mean, you can pick any topic, and I'm going to say, okay, you know, global climate change.
Right.
Here's a chart, here's the temperature of the Earth, and here's man-made CO2. They don't match. The facts are over. But
well,
you can do that for any single point.
It's a very important point. It's a very important, effective way to do that. I do think we see that in some measure on the conservative front of pushing back on social media. But what ends up happening? You go to get the word out and you get canceled. Your account gets suspended. Your account gets banned. That's the problem. Back in the days of Ross Perot, he could buy television programs. He was buying hours at a time on the networks. We all remember those, right? Sunday night, Thursday night. And, right. He would break everything down for you. Well, we no longer have that opportunity because most people aren't consuming television at the same time. But what the left has been very good at, and I'm not talking your idea down, I'm just explaining. What the left has been good at is controlling the parameters of where the debate can happen. And saying, listen, if you try to put this on social media, you're going to become an unperson. We're going to block you. We're going to ban you. We're going to suspend you. We're going to put you into the memory hole. So it's about having that information available on websites or in a particular location and then being able to use that. Now, here, let me say this. RushLimbaugh.com has an amazing amount of information on that site. And you can go there as a member and you can pull up arguments and conversations and riffs and monologues, and all that stuff was built by Rush over the years with his argumentation for 32-33 years, and that is an endless supply of that. So I always recommend people to go to rushlimbaugh.com and to join Rush 24/7, right? Because it's an important, invaluable resource that will provide the sort of stuff that you're talking about. Sal, you're a great call. I love your passion. Call back again. Randall is in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Randall, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Yeah, according to the Constitution, the people are supposed to run the country through the government. But what's happening right now is the Democrats want to run the people through the government, which is tyranny.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the Democrat Party wants to bend the will of the people to match the government. If you don't conform to what the Democrat Party wants,
right,
then they want to cancel you, they want to
right,
throw you in jail,
right,
they want to do whatever
mm-hmm,
they can
mm-hmm,
to bend mm-hmm, to bend you to the government.
Well,
and
okay,
that's not the way. That's complete tyranny.
Randall, I appreciate the call. Let me break it down this way. What they're attempting to do is federalize all the institutions they can. They want to federalize the schools. They want to federalize voting. They want to federalize the border. Well, no, not really. They want to federalize as many institutions as they can, and they're doing that through the aggressive use of money going out the door. They want everybody as dependent as they can be from cradle to grave, because they know there's votes in that there pile. I'm Brett Winterble, your guide host today on the EIB Network. You know, President Biden is acting like Santa Claus. We heard as much from Rush earlier in the program, and it's exactly what the Democrats always want to do. They want to be Santa Claus. They want to give out all this stuff and tell you it's free, free, free. But it's not free. And in many cases, it's not necessarily wanted. Rush took a phone call from a single father named Cliff, and Cliff did not want government help.
Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Cliff. I'm glad you called. Great to have you on the program. Hello.
Hi, Mr. Limbaugh. It's an honor and privilege to speak with you today, sir. I'm a single father, and I speak to multiple single women, and they, when they find out that I am a single father, you know, it kind of piques their interest, and they just tell me, I mean, I don't make a lot of money, but I go out and I work every day and do the things that I ought to do. But, I mean, they just tell me about program after program after program that they can get involved with and just milk the system.
The single women tell you this?
Yes, yes.
How does this even come up? Is this part of courtship?
No, sir, not at all. It's just that they talk about all these things that they get from the government for not being married and having children. It's like, they just mentioned it to me. Do you know?
If your point is that they are fully aware of how to game the system, I don't doubt that at all. That's the whole point. The Democrat Party has rigged the game to make government attractive. The single mothers, single women don't need men, don't need a husband. The government will do that for them.
I understand that, but it just amazes me. You know, it's like they tell me, you know, well, have you gone to collect child support? I'm like, no, I don't need it. Well, it's like they say that the child support office, they have all this literature that they can give you about how to get on these programs and how to get rent assistance and utility assistance and food stamps. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, what? It baffles me.
Why?
I do it on my own. No problem.
I know. You have a different value set. It doesn't occur to you to have somebody else take care of you. It doesn't occur to you that your friends and neighbors ought to pay for what you want. But the Democrat Party has created this atmosphere among people that they're owed something, that they're entitled, that life has been unfair, that America has savaged them, and brutish men have come along and been mean to them, and so the government's going to make it right. And they've got them programmed here to be taken care of by Democrats and government. Obamacare, among whatever else it is a giant grab bag for unmarried women. It plays on every fear they have. It plays on every stereotype they believe. Basically, Obamacare and the entire Democrat agenda basically says to unmarried women, you are discriminated against. You're treated unfairly. You get taken advantage of. You don't get in relationship. Nobody loves you. You end up having babies that you can't support. The dreaded fathers are never around. They walk out on you. They don't pay their child support. We will. They don't pay your prenatal, your postnatal. We will. They don't pay for your little garden in the back of your 800-square-foot studio apartment. We will. They don't pay for your bus tokens to ride our mass transit. We will. They're not going to give you birth control pills so you go out and do whatever you want with whoever you want, however many times. We will.
The notion of restoring independence or encouraging independence is such an important thing. The idea that, well, wait, let me see what I can do in terms of achieving this myself without having to first turn to government. Is there a support system around me that I can possibly tap into or something I can possibly put together myself? I think it's worth looking into that conversation. Let's head back out on the phones. Let's talk to Jim, El Paso, Texas. Jim, welcome to the program. You know, I grew up in El Paso, Texas. I'm happy to have you here.
Really, Brent? Well, that's interesting. Well, I was born and raised here for over 60 years now.
Wonderful.
So I'm very familiar with this border town all my life. Brent, the reason I call is that you had a caller earlier questioning as to why you think that and he said in general, he did say in general,
yeah.
African-Americans tend to vote for Democrats, and mm-hmm. Your answer was basically there's pockets, got to be careful not to lump them all together and stuff. And I agree with you 99.9% of the time, but on this one I had to call because the reality is that about 85%, I believe it is the latest figure, vote Democrat.
Yeah.
And that doesn't constitute pockets. It constitutes the vast majority of African-Americans voting Democrat. So, I just wanted to touch that on that thing. I think you gave more of a politically correct answers of pockets and stuff like that. But the other thing is offer a solution, not just complaints, but solutions. You know, solution, okay, I think that incentivizing, first of all, they try to destroy the nuclear family, and they have been very successful, the Democrats, against African-Americans. That was step number one that they did. And then they decentivize them from working, getting out by giving them free this and free that, which is what they're doing again with everybody now. And so what do you do? Try to put back the nuclear family, incentivize to get out of the rut of living in government housing and food stamps and stuff like that. That's what Donald Trump was trying to do.
Right.
And then educate them and make them realize, see them, not make them, but allow them to realize that they're being used by these people, by the Democratic Party, the party of the Ku Klux Klan and Jim Crow and segregation. And all I have to do is go to the library because it's no longer online. And the library is a good source for them to see that this is a truth. It's a truth about the history of the Democratic Party.
I think the most important point you raise, and certainly we can disagree about the wording I'm using, but I think the most important thing you raise is the idea that you're going to have to go out there and sell the messaging to people on the granular level. Now, Donald Trump was successful at that. He pulled in, whatever the number might be, 12%, 14% of the black vote in 2020. But that is because he made a concerted effort. I remember back in 2016 when he went into Detroit and his pitch was, what the hell do you have to lose? You've been trying this thing for 60, 70, 80 years. This is what you have to do. And so I agree with the sentiment. But what has to happen is, you have to go out there and you have to earn every vote you're going to get. And that means going door to door, house to house, location to location to convince people. There is no way to throw a great tarp over an area and say, OK, now we have captured your votes. That's not the case because it takes a long time to build in the mind of people the need to start asking questions. Why am I accepting this level of this standard of living provided to me by the government or whatever it is? Why am I not aspiring to more than that? And so what needs to be preached in many ways, needs to be evangelized, is freedom, is liberty, is the opportunity to get up and to change the direction of your life. We often hear about the bending of the arc of the moral universe. Well, nobody's destiny is set until the moment they leave this earth. You have a chance every day to do better for yourself and your family. And I think that's the important messaging. Jim, I appreciate the call. You're a terrific caller. Please call again. I'm Brent Witterbull, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show. But let me say this first. This is very important for you to know, especially Jim out there, okay? Your cell phone has become your constant companion. And I mention it now, and your mind immediately connects to where your cell phone is at this instant, right? What you don't know is what your next cell phone is going to be. It is a big mystery every month. Unless you have Pure Talk cell phone service, it's a great company with every customer service employee here in the United States. Equally important, you can count on your bill just being $30 a month, each and every month. Rush has the details.
Hey, folks, there's one sure bet that you can make this year, and that is you're going to use your cell phone more than you did last year. That translates to bigger cell phone bills. You're going to be paying more for it, unless you are proactive and do something about that. This is why so many people in this audience are switching their cell phone service from one of the big providers to Pure Talk. Pure Talk offers you unlimited talk, unlimited text, and 6 gigs of data for just $30 a month. And if you go over on data, they don't charge you for it. They don't charge you if you go over your 6 gigs of data. Now, you compare that monthly price, $30 a month, to your current cell phone bill. Just compare it. Your current cell phone bill, I mean, I'd say make a guess, but $75, $80, depending on how many lines and phones you have. Don't know what it is, but $30 a month for unlimited talk, unlimited text, 6 gigs of data. Now, here's the real icing on the cake. Pure Talk uses the same cell phone towers as one of the biggest cell phone service providers in America. They focus on providing great service and support with every Pure Talk employee located in the U.S. From your cell phone, do this. Dial #250 and say Pure Talk. Get started. You'll save 50% off your first month. That's #250 and say Pure Talk. Just pick up your phone right now. #250 and say Pure Talk. Guess what? Somebody from there will answer and you're off and running.
Do it. I'm Brett Witterble, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh. It's my favorite, one of my favorite parts of the show. The EIB high note. The EIB high note. We mentioned it earlier in the program that it'd be coming towards the end of the program. It's about the world's oldest known wild bird. Let that sink in. It's the world's oldest known wild bird, a Laysan albatross named Wisdom, who just hatched another chick at, wait for it, age 70. Age 70. Now, Rush loved cool facts, and this story from the Good News Network, which you'll be able to find over at the website, is chock full of them. For example, almost as amazing as being a parent at 70 is the number of miles Wisdom has flown. By the time she was 60, she had logged at least 2 to 3 million miles since she was first banded in 1956. That's 4 to 6 trips from the Earth to the Moon and back. That's with plenty of miles to spare. One reason for all those frequent flyer miles is that every Laysan albatross spends their first 3 to 5 years fledgling at sea, never touching the land. That's pretty cool stuff. Now, longtime Rush listeners know that Rush's favorite bird was the pelican. So we thought this was the perfect opportunity to revisit some of Rush's thoughts on this great bird.
One of my favorite, all-time favorite birds is a pelican. I'm fascinated by the things. And a pelican's my favorite bird next to the eagle. I have this fantasy one day that a pelican's going to land in front of me and I'll be able to pet it. It'll never happen, but I still have the fantasy.
There's a drone photo. My favorite bird's a pelican. And this picture is of a pelican. Pelican's flying just below the drone. And a pelican is in the picture. Now, I mentioned that pelicans, one of my all-time favorite birds. Even though I live on a beach, you can't get too close to these things because unless they're in captivity, then they charge you wanting to be fed. But you have to go to a preserve for that. In the wild, you know, they kind of flee. Back in December, I was playing golf, and there's a freshwater lake on this golf course. And I noticed there were two pelicans. This is a picture I took. I was able to get that close to them. These two guys didn't flinch.
By the way, these two women, they arranged for a carving of a pelican. Pelican's my all-time favorite bird. They arranged for the carving of a pelican. We keep it here in the public lobby of the EIB broadcast complex. Two sisters, we've mentioned them on this program before. They sent me a gorgeous bronze sculpture of a pelican that we have back there. Wouldn't the world be a greater place if there were more pelicans than there were seagulls? I understand why, but we can all dream. We can all have hope for the future that the pelican population might someday overwhelm the seagull population.
We can all pray. We can all hope for that. Hey, by the way, Dean Carianis, a.k.a. Coco Jr., over at the website, he actually helped Rush get closer to his dream of petting a pelican once. You know what he did? He was over in London, And he had the opportunity to get close to a tame pelican, right, in captivity. And he opened up his iPhone and brought up a shot of Rush. And he had a picture taken of him showing Rush's picture to the pelican. And that's how he was able to produce that meeting over in London between the pelican and Rush. And Rush loved the picture. He was absolutely fired up by that. I like to think that Rush is surrounded by lots of pelicans up there in heaven. Before we wrap up today, though, a reminder about our new podcast series, giving you a firsthand look at the man who brought us all together, Rush. It's hosted by James Golden, who's here to introduce it.
Thank you, Brett. I'm so excited for you to hear the new podcast series, Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the Golden EIB microphone. It's our chance to share with you what kind of man he was to be with and remind us all why he was so special to so many. It's a remarkable journey of triumphs, of challenges, and most of all, the pursuit of excellence. You'll find this podcast series starting May 12th on iHeartRadio or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. It's presented by the Tunnel to Towers Foundation and MyPillow.
We'll have some final thoughts straight ahead. I'm Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. You know, looking back and thinking about what it is that we've seen play out today after that speech last night and how it's going to play out, Nehru had a great quote, and it's important for us to remember this on the importance of free will and how we get to choose how we live our lives in this go-round. He said, "Life is like a game of cards. The hand you're dealt is determinism. The way you play it is free will. You're handed certain cards. And the way you choose to handle those cards, how you choose to play that game, that's the representation of free will right there." And it's important to preserve that for each and every human being. Vitally important to preserve that, because it's all we have is our choices and our opportunity and our dreams. And government should never, ever supplant that. I'm Brett Witterbull on the EIB Network.